floor temperature down to about 64.
Blog Talk Radio.
Start the day out. High temperatures in the upper 70s, low temperatures at 62. For Friday and running up into the 4th of July weekend, more sunshine expected. High temperatures on the rise in the low 80s to the mid 80s.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Vasily and Transformation Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is Dr. John DeMartini. This is one of the most amazing and inspiring shows that you can listen into. If you want to be on the edge of your seats, if you want to open up your heart, if you want to expand your mind, and you want to meet incredible people, stay tuned, because you're just about to experience a transformative radio show that will change your life. And you're listening to the Dr. Pat Show is coming up right next.
Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. Talk radio to thrive by. Powerful, inspiring, and coming to you live, bringing you stories of people like you and me, busting through and living life full out. Get ready to dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail.
Hey, everybody, welcome. You know, a long time ago, we would be talking about what are the things that are on our minds. But I will tell you, if you live where I live, you went through and you have seen something that many people didn't know they'd see in the Pacific Northwest. But I've got somebody here today, Joseph Latino, joining me here today, bedbug expert and president of Allergy Technologies. And the reason we're talking about this is because there is a level of awareness we need. The degree of infestation that was here in apartments, especially, I know this from my property management friends, extraordinary is an understatement, but we need some information. Joseph, thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
People don't really understand how big this problem is, do they?
No, they don't. And it's unfortunately, as you were alluding to, kind of swept under the carpet, so to speak.
Yeah.
No one really wants to talk about this icky, you know, this icky pest. But the problem is ubiquitous throughout the United States.
Yeah.
It really, you know, you said Pacific Northwest. It's kind of stealing my line because I say it's from the Pacific Northwest to the Florida Keys, coast to coast.
Yep.
You see, all of these various national service providers, they put up their top 20 or top 50 lists of bedbug-infested cities. And you know all the majors are there, all the major urban centers, but then you start seeing all the small ones. I mean, you do see Seattle, you see Tacoma.
Yep.
You do see all little cities, and I'm not picking anybody out in particular. It's a ubiquitous problem. And, you know, the National Pest Management Association has put together some factoids I'd like to share with your listeners.
Yeah, let's share them right now.
Most pests, 97% of all pest professionals treated for bed bugs last year, and the prevalence is increasing. The three top places where pest professionals report finding bed bugs are single-family homes and apartments and condos, which represent 90% of the time, and hotels and motels are right behind them. But you can also find them in higher numbers in nursing homes, schools and daycare centers, offices, college dorms, hospitals, and public transportation. However, I think the single largest repository of bed bugs in the U.S. is generally considered by experts to be affordable housing and likely the most difficult to gain control because there are so many factors that preclude its proper control, including cash constraints, concerns over being evicted, the social stigma of bed bugs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I want to just jump to really what's at the heart of this is and I want to say this to everybody listening, the greatest pothole you're going to step into, and Joseph, this is my opinion, the greatest pothole you're going to step into is thinking that you can go buy a can of something, spray your house, and it'll be all done. Out of everything that, you know, I've learned about this, that is so not the thing to do. Let's talk about solving this because I really don't know how this gets solved without experts coming in and taking care of it.
You've hit the nail on the head. The concept of DIY or do-it-yourselfers, unless it's a very unique individual with a very mild introduction, homeowners, anyone, hotel owners, property managers, et cetera, don't have the armament or array of pesticides to use or the heating equipment to use. But more importantly, they don't haven't been trained on how to use it and what a safe application is. Unfortunately, more people, I think, have died from inappropriate pesticide use than actually killing the target pest. And that's just not the way to go. Calling the pros, I know it's expensive. I know it may really strain the budget. But frankly, I don't know of another effective way of remediating.
Yeah. And by the way, the psychological impact of this is devastating to people. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can look at in your home and say, I've got to take care of this and I've got to take care of this. But the minute you say bed bugs, that is like everybody's eyes just stop. And can we talk about, you know, what programs you are aware of that can take care of this? And besides this being an annoyance, you know, this is something to be seriously concerned about. It's not just an annoyance.
Well, I think there are actually two ways to look at this. Mm-hmm. It's the reactionary way or the preventive way. Mm-hmm. My company, we've taken the preventive paradigm, which is more of a unique approach, but it's starting to gain some traction. Reactive approaches, meaning you wait till you have the problem and then you treat it, is just throwing money down a sinkhole. Because unless you put in some measures of prevention that are long-lasting, you have the opportunity to have the problem all over again, and it becomes a vicious cycle. I think that looking at it from a preventive approach, and, you know, history always has told us that prevention is always the better way to go, whether we're looking at medical diseases or we're looking at pest control or anything else for that matter. It usually costs a little bit up front, but certainly it pays for itself in the long run. We happen to have a product, for example, that is solely used on bedding, on mattresses and box springs and things of that nature, sleeping surfaces, and it prevents infestations from establishing. It's not meant to treat an infested room. It's only to be used as the last step in a remediative or curative program, but it's the first step if you want to take a preventive approach. So I think the mindset of the listeners, hopefully, is, you know what, I want to get in front of the curve here. I don't want to wait till I have the problem and then have to deal with the devastation. I'd rather deal with it from a preventive standpoint.
You know, and let's just call this a proactive standpoint, if you don't mind, because once upon a time, this was not something you heard about. And what I mean about that, Joseph, is that every once in a while, I'm from New York, and so... Yeah, so you hear about it in New York, and I grew up in the projects, and I understand what it's like, you know, to live in some of the structures in New York City. Everybody's together. It's all together. And, you know, one of the things that happens is you get used to hearing about things. But this is a much bigger situation now. This is not just New York. You know, when Western Washington, and I'm going to say Western Washington, when we are hearing the level of infestation here in the Pacific Northwest, I just don't understand how you cannot be proactive about it. What do people need to know? Where do they go to get information? Because the folks that are listening, they need to go to their tenant landlords. They need to go to their property managers and say, you folks need to get ahead of this. How do they do that?
Well, there are a few. I think the best way is arming yourself with information. I would welcome anyone to come to our website, allergytechnology.com, and you'll get a wealth of information. I would ask to speak to your pest control operators. Typically, their websites are replete of information. They can go to their extensionists. Every city has a research extensionist from the university in that city that is in entomology. They will have a resource of information. I think the best prepared person is the one that has the most information. In terms of, you used the word proactive versus preventive. I'm glad you brought that distinction up. We cannot, nor anyone can prevent a bed bug from introducing into a facility.
Right.
This is not Star Trek. There are no force fields. There are no way of stopping it.
Yep.
What we can, however, is we can stop an introduction, which is defined as one or two bed bugs or three bed bugs coming in, stopping that from proliferating into an infestation.
Right.
And that's what we define as prevention.
Right. And that's the proactive nature of it. I mean, I'm looking at this akin to, you know, what level of awareness happened in the Northeast when it came to ticks and Lyme disease. And we're really talking about the same kind of proactive action that needs to be taken, because you nailed it. One or two, proactive, you get rid of. One or two turning into 200, that's a different scenario, Joseph, isn't it?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, we have an adage. I use it a lot. I'd rather treat the snowball than the avalanche.
I love it.
So,
I think for me, the takeaway from this today and to our listeners is you got to get out in front of this. You really have to get out in front of this. And, you know, please tell folks again how they do that. And I'd love to know your personal message. I'd love to know what you'd like to leave us with today.
Oh, wow. Just become as knowledgeable as you can. Don't hide from it. It's an icky subject, but become knowledgeable. Recognize that there are a lot of, I don't want to sound like a political message. It sounds like the Oscars. I don't want this to sound other than become as aware of the problem as possible. Think of all opportunities, make your own decisions, but recognize that you don't have to succumb to just treating. When it comes to bedbugs, prevention or proactive approach is possible.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for getting out here and educating everybody, but this is really a call to action. Yeah, I want people to know that get your education, do your research, but please do something. Thanks, Joseph. We're going to take a short break. Everybody, we'll be right back.
Does your life often feel like an emotional tsunami where rogue waves crash down on you, leaving you feeling hopeless and wondering if it will ever end? Do you wish to awaken the dormant strength inside of you? Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Start today by scheduling a complimentary consultation with Martinet. Dive into your healing journey and begin to see your life in a new light. Visit martinetemmons.com and make your appointment today. We figured by the time we turned 50, we kind of had life figured out, but we were not prepared for the realities of midlife. Tune into And That's When I Realized, the truth and comedy of midlife, with me, Susan Dolce,
and me, Leon Dyer, every second and fourth Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You're not alone in these challenges, and sometimes you just gotta laugh.
Find us at SusanDolce.com and LeonDyer.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to our good news segment. More importantly, you know, welcome to a great conversation about how we look at organizations, how we look at ourselves in organizations. You know, the other day, I talked with you all about a show that I did many years ago and continue to do called Enlightened Capitalism. And, you know, when you say those two words together, most people look at you sideways and they just want to think, what are you talking about? Well, think about this now. Here we are. You're ready to make a global impact. Are you ready to step up and celebrate diversity? Are you ready to believe in sustainability beyond your wildest imagination? Because if you are, you're going to want to talk to Carrie Freed. Carrie, founder and co-CEO of Second Use and YPO member, and here's why we're talking about this. What is it about change now that has tapped into and has touched just about everybody? Because no matter how you cut it, you've gone through significant change. But what happens when you change and you forget that leadership is an essential part of any organization? Carrie, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just love thinking about good news, right? That's just such an important thing in this day and age. Yes, there are amazing things happening out there. Let's celebrate good news.
Exactly. And, you know, we're a completely positive talk network. I mean, and the show has been like that for 17 years. But, you know, when I think about my background in leadership and I think about my background in business, you know, I wonder where we are in the world today. And so this is the conversation with you as you come forward, right, and look at how do we advise, how do we become those folks that are part of a community that's doing more than 9 to 5? What was it about this that tapped you on the shoulder, or better yet, touched your heart so that you said, I'm all in?
Such a great question. And, you know, I will say that I think more and more, I'll get back to the question that you asked,
sure.
More and more employees and other people are yearning for purpose, broader purpose beyond themselves. You can look at so many studies, whether it's on employee engagement or just purpose in general, different, you know, and it crosses the generations. People want more than the 9-to-5, truly. They want to be contributing to something bigger and something better. So I think that that's just something that is continuing to flourish, and it's here to stay. Back in high school, you know, I started reading actually something very similar to this talk show, and learning about all the good that was happening in the world, and this notion that business truly could be used as a force for good. That wasn't the lingo at the time, but it stuck in my brain. And so for, you know, the better part of, I don't know, 25, 30 years, that's been my focus. And it works. And it works in any sort of organization, whatever type of organization you have, you can lead with purpose and really be a force for good.
You know, and let's talk about this in a number of different ways, because this is really a change energetically, evolutionarily, and I think I made that word up right there. And
good.
I was like, where did that come from? Boom, there it is. But, you know, if you're somebody like me and you know what it's like to work your way up in a corporation, start at $61 in a mailroom, in a company that you never thought would go away, and you found yourself in the middle of one of the most profound divestitures on the planet, and that is, what shall I say, the phone company. We don't even call it a phone anymore. And what do you learn from that? What do you take from that? And so, Carrie, this is what I want to ask you about what we're talking about here today, about global leadership, you know, and the community of that, and what does it mean to announce, you know, an Impact Award winner, because people have an impact. They make a difference. And yet we don't remind them enough of that.
Yeah, so that's something that I think about all the time. You know, what is the role of leadership? And I think the role of leadership is truly in helping serve people, serve others in a way that creates positive change. So that's your employees, that's your stakeholders, your customers. And that doesn't change. Whatever organization you're in, if you're helping improve, if you're being of service to people and to humanity, that's constant. And so I truly think of it as these are just basic leadership skills in my mind. Yes, of course, you have to paint the vision. You have to create trust, all those things. But I think it's truly this coming from it from a very conscientious servant perspective.
You know... Let's talk about why we're here today for a minute. There are many reasons why we're here today, but we're talking about the leadership role you have. We're talking about Second Muse. Let's talk about that for a minute because, you know, first of all, I love it. I love the whole Second Muse. Just the energy about it is just like totally groundbreaking. But when we think about that, what does Second Muse do? How does it bring people together? How does it help build networks? And more importantly, I'm going to give you like 5 questions. And more importantly, what's happening is we have never been more acutely aware of gender inequality and racial inequality. I don't think we've ever been more aware of that.
Right. I would agree.
What can we do?
What can we do? So I think the first thing that we can do is acknowledge it and acknowledge the times that we are in right now. You know, this is not going away. This is something that continues to be very persistent. And until we come together to actually address and repair, in some cases, this and solve it, it's going to be with us. And I think that just continues to escalate. Our team was just in Tulsa this past weekend, honoring and recognizing the Tulsa Wall Street Massacre and launching a new program there that is specifically focused on racial inclusion in the tech industry.
Mm-hmm.
We do quite a bit in the tech industry. We're really industry agnostic, but we do quite a bit there focused on both gender equality as well as racial equality.
You know, in your tenure, in the time that you've been engaged, The question that I love to talk about, and I love when we have an opportunity to talk about, is how has your engagement in bringing a new level of awareness changed you?
Mm-hmm. It's such a good question. I feel like I'm constantly learning. I'm learning. I mean, it's a never-ending evolution. I've told people, gosh, and I just at some point say, hey, I've made it, I've arrived, and I'm done. And honestly, that doesn't work. You know, I think it's constantly looking at how do we ourselves improve? How do we improve the way we show up every day? About a year and a half ago, I really started thinking of how do you lead with love? And that's a little crazy talk, you know, for me, even 8 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago.
Yeah.
How do you truly lead with love? It's like, what? That's nuts. That's just this corporate. Don't say that word. Don't say the big L word.
No hugging.
No hugging. I know. I totally turned into a you know, the corporate hugger and love speaker, and it's like, oh gosh, she's out there.
But you know, look, I have to tell you this, and this is why I'm so excited to talk to you today, is that first of all, I want to make sure that people that are listening to this understand that what we're talking about here is whatever you want to call it. It is a version of consciousness that we have to really pay attention to. And let's say it, conscious capitalism. You know, what is that about? Well, Carrie, here's the deal. You know, the latest study that was taken by, I think it was Sodesto, you know, the recruiting firm. And, you know, the latest study that they did when they asked the people, the young folks just coming out, they asked them the same poll they ask them every year. Like, what is the most important thing to you? Well, shocking, and this is a recruiting firm worst nightmare. Shocking, you know, none of the regular tidbits were there. Not the money, not this, not the benefit, not the 4 weeks vacation. They clearly stated that empathy and compassion in an organization was their number one across the board. What do you make of that? And what is the relationship to that, to conscious capitalism, what y'all doing?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is so key. And, I, you know, that's something that we should just keep saying and letting absorb into leadership mm-hmm. mindset, quite frankly, because it's so key. And when I think about all the ways business has been created, you know, traditional business, it is really, there's been so much good in the world. So I'm very pro-business.
Oh, yeah.
But it has also come at the cost lots of times of human dignity. Whether that's employees or the communities that we operate in or whatever it is, it's just this, you know, it's very transactional oftentimes. And so when I think about conscious capitalism, I think about it in terms of how do we care for humans, quite frankly, whether they're our employees or our customers or clients or, you know, whatever it is, how do we care for humans? How do we create space and an environment that is empathetic? And I think if you're so focused on the transactional way of doing things, it doesn't, you know, it's not going to feel like what these people are looking for and yearning for.
Yeah.
So I truly think that conscious capitalism is just kind of one, the recognition mm-hmm. that people and the planet really do matter to all of us. And we need to at times slow down and just really rethink relationships. At the core of everything is relationships, right? That's how we get things done, quite frankly. Technology exists. It's going to. We're going to continue to advance it. But, I mean, we can send satellites to Mars. We can, you know, develop a vaccine in less than 12 months.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, it's hearts and minds that are going to change things and make things feel better.
Yeah. Well, look at you. Congratulations to you. So let's get to a little meat of this today. You've been named the 2021 YPO Global Impact Award winner, and congratulations. It's a prestigious honor. It celebrates, you know, CEO impact, significant, sustainable, and for you, your work with Second Muse, you know, supporting business and building diversity and resilient economies, right? You know, here you are, your guidance and leadership engaged hundreds of thousands of people, you know, through economic education. Oh my gosh, how important is that? And really looking at how to manage money in a consciously connected way. What does it feel like to receive that award for you?
honestly, if I'm being completely honest, I feel like it is such a confirmation for all the work that we've been doing for a decade plus. You know, I think there are times when we really just get focused on running a business and having impact and doing the right thing. And, you know, I left the big corporate world. I was at Intel, and I had lots of different opportunities, and I just saw this as something that needed to be done in the world and something that attracts organizations and humans, like this whole idea of collaborating and bringing people together to address, you know, these big market inequalities. It's fascinating. And so we've been doing that, and it's confirmation is really what it is. I'm proud. I'm inspired. I feel very humbled. And quite frankly, it's like, okay, good. All this, I've been working so hard for a good decade on this, and here we are.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's exciting to talk to you, and that's why this is good news. Yeah, first of all, before we just skip ahead here and just have to end this conversation, I want people to know, how do they find out about YPO? How do they find out about Second Muse? Give us some information, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So Second Muse, find us at secondmuse.com or on your favorite social media platform handle. We're there. You know, it's easy to connect with us. So definitely just go find us. Learn more about us. There's all sorts of great things constantly out there for my team members and our work. And YPO is ypo.org. It is a truly fantastic global organization of executives that are really trying to lead with purpose, I would say.
You know, I definitely want people to get to know you better. I want them to really see what you're doing and see how you're helping women move through the roadblocks, because the roadblocks are in the boardroom, and we know that they're in the boardroom. And, you know, you and I as leaders and owners of companies, you know, somebody pointed something interesting out to me the other day. This is something we have to work on, Carrie. I think this is something women have to work on. They pointed something out to me the other day, and I just looked at them, and they said, do you know you're CEO of a broadcast network, digital television and radio? You know, do you know that? And I just looked at him, Carrie, and I said, oh, geez, I go to work every day. and I mean every day. Of course I know that. And, you know, it's interesting what the comment was. Nobody else knows that. And so we are, what they're saying is,
I know,
you people need to get out there. You people need to get out there. How do we help women gather up a powerful voice? And that's my last question for you. How do we do that?
Mm-hmm. I think by doing what you're doing right here, quite frankly. You know, there's so many things, but I think at the end of the day, putting women on stage, promoting them, advocating for them, honoring them, quite frankly, I think is one of the largest signals that we can send. You know, there's all sorts of behind the scenes mentoring and supporting and, you know, trying to get on board. But at the end of the day, women need to know the power that they have, and other women need to be able to see women in these roles.
Yeah.
You know, there's just not, quite frankly, there's just not enough of us doing all these different things, and there just really isn't, I have to say. I'm like,
I know.
We have more. You know, I've been recruiting more women to YPO in my local chapter, and I'm like, we need more women. I know there are more women leading. And so, yeah, let's make us more visible in any way we can.
Let's grow the YPO. Let's do it. Look, I want to thank you for today. I know you've got to hop off. There's so much more that you and I could talk about, especially about leadership and leader-member exchange, psychological contracts, contract violation, broken promises. Notice that's the area that I study.
I love it. I love it, too. No, I'm with you. We can spend hours on this. This is great.
I hope you will come back. Thank you. What's your personal message right now? What do you want to leave us with? And thank you for today.
Think how you can lead with purpose every day in everything you do.
Man, I'm all over that with Carrie. Thank you, Carrie, so much for being you, and thank you for going beyond being you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You betcha.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you, Ted. Everybody, let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack, and yes, our office is open, and we are doing strictly phone consultations. If you would like to call and get tuned up, it's perfect time with everything that's going on and things are calming down. Pick up the phone and give us a call. It's quick and easy and it's fun. If you'd like more information on it, you can look at MaryJaneMack.com or call our office at 888-777-4232.
Your inspiration all day on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome to Blue Lightning Healing Meditation. I'm Susie Parker Nolan. I'm a channel bringing through spirit guides in accessible and resonant ways for you to connect with your higher self, sharing soul-level conversations to help you in your spiritual path. I upload weekly, channeled messages, interviews, and information on a variety of topics, sharing my learning and opening doors for growth. You can find a listing of upcoming podcasts at BlueLightningHealing.com. Until next time, blessings.
TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Hey everybody, I'm so thrilled about today's good news segment. Acclaimed makeup artist Ellen Ellen Avendano joins us here today about personal skin care, personal skin condition, and Dr. Jennifer Song is joining us as well, dermatologist, director of clinical research at Southern California Dermatology in Santa Ana. You know, when I think about what happens when you put an acclaimed makeup artist together with an expert in the field of dermatology, what you find is groundbreaking, innovative, creative, and clearly out of the box. That's what today's about. We have a new campaign to tell you about. My favorite word, empower. That's what these two are about. Alan, Dr. Jennifer, great to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having us. That was a great intro, and now I'm empowered.
Let's talk for a minute if we could. A lot of commercials, a lot of things we've been seeing, a lot of awareness now, but clearly not an understanding about plaque psoriasis. And this, for me, is one of the most pivotal conversations we can have today, because there are experiences that happen with living with plaque psoriasis, right? You know, and this is something that we need to bring to the forefront. Misunderstanding, stigmas, whatever you want to say. But Alan, this has been your journey and pathway.
Yes, absolutely. I was diagnosed at a really young age. I was stuck in a family home fire, and it was a very traumatic and stressful experience. Not burnt, but the trauma started causing these white, scaly patches that were on my elbows, knees, and then all of a sudden it spread to my body and my face. And so, you know, you grow up going through school, you experience a lot of bullying, you experience the whole not being chosen in PE, you know, sitting alone at lunch. People would just comment on, like, the inflammation that I would be dealing with, called so many different things, because I was extremely red. A lot of times when it's inflamed, it's just red, a burgundy-ish color. So, you know, you got everything. And that's why I was really excited to partner up with Amgen and Otezla on this Inside Look campaign, because so passionate about helping people be confident and positive and loving themselves. And, you know, if you go to InsideLookPSO.com, you'll get to learn more about my story, and you'll also get to meet a woman named Sarah, who has moderate to severe plaque psoriasis, and we get to give her a psoriasis-friendly makeup tutorial, but it also encourages people to see their doctors virtually or in office to discuss their treatment plans to help them if they're suffering with this, and also just be confident with life and to roll with the punches and overcome hurdles.
Oh, that's what the entire network's about. Wow, you just summed it up in like 3 seconds. I love it. Alan, but that is it. That is really what we're talking about here today. It's so pivotal, especially in the world we're living in today, where everything is so in our face, right? I mean, you cannot not have something in your face in the world we live in today. But what you're talking about is not just an empowering message, but a message about action. Dr. Jennifer, this is now for you, because, you know, here we are listening to what Alan has to say. And listening to this journey, it is inspirational. And, you know, for you, what we're looking at is the groundbreaking, and how should I say it,
innovation that we're seeing in the field of dermatology, especially around this, what excites you the most?
Absolutely. That's why I'm here, and that's why I'm a dermatologist, is that I want to help patients living with psoriasis like Alan confront their disease and live their life. There are so many treatment options, and I have been working treating psoriasis patients, doing clinical research for over 10 years in psoriasis now. And I can really say I'm so excited about all the different treatment options that are now available for patients. There are creams that you can apply to the skin, light therapy, oral medications like pills, as well as injectable medicines called biologics. The one that we're talking about specifically today is Otezla, also called Opemba. And it's not a cream, it's not an injectable, and it's not a biologic. It's a pill that treats moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. So really important for patients to work closely with their doctor to find a treatment plan that works for them.
You know, I think, let me just tell you why this is so seriously important in so many ways. You know, if we were talking about this, oh, okay, let me just go back. Please, don't pass out right now. If we go back 50 years, and we're having a conversation about this, I know, right, Alan's like, what? We go back 50 years. Just to put this in perspective, right, you could have plaque psoriasis and nobody in the world would know unless it was so visible. In the world we're living in today, it is extremely difficult not to have whatever it is that goes on with an individual, whether it's good, bad, different, you know, or ugly. It doesn't matter. It gets in the public. We have a new level of awareness about this. And Alan, isn't this what you are talking about when you talk about bullying? I mean, beyond bullying, there's a complete misunderstanding about it. And that, I think, is one of the most harmful things. You're isolated and you're stigmatized, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's physically, emotionally, mentally exhausting and traumatic. I spent years, like if you're looking back 50 years, yes, you could cover it up. That's what I did most of my childhood, long-sleeve shirts, pants, sweatshirts in the middle of summer in Los Angeles. It's not fun. And I would get oversized long sleeves so that I could cover my hands, which are the most seen. And so this is what the beauty is of how we are today, how we're able to actually turn that into a positive where everything is seen, because now everyone can talk about this. People are aware. There's so much more knowledge about it, and especially with this website, insidelookpso.com. I just want to drill that in people's heads because I'm so proud of it, so excited about it, the encouragement you'll receive, the relatability to people who are dealing with and living with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. It's a big deal. I wish I had that when I was younger. I wish that, you know, I had a great family and support system that really helped me and helped me realize that I was so much more than this skin condition. But maybe some people don't have that. And so this is sort of that for them. And, you know, I just want to educate others and honestly, again, feel confident in their skin. And by the way, as a makeup artist on here, we talk about making sure that, you know, you're gentle with your skin and, you know, instead of the focus being on trying to cover everything up, why don't you highlight the features that you love and bring attention to that?
Yeah.
Because it is what it is. There's times when you're not going to be able to cover up. It's so irritated or, you know, you react to certain makeup products. But highlight the features that you have. It is what it is. Show your inner beauty. Show your personality. And that's what the focus is going to be on, not what's on your skin.
Oh, I love it. Boy, this is a short interview. I wish you guys were here longer. Dr. Song, I want to ask you a question, you know, because listening to Alan, right, you know, what you have is, boy, a lifetime of experience, but you are an expert in psoriasis treatment. You have, and I love this because I'm a researcher myself, so anytime I see a peer-reviewed journal article and lectures, I'm like, oh, okay, I got to read this stuff. But here you are. Your experience is every day. You see patients every day. I want to ask you about the campaign, how people find out more. And I got to ask you, how has this changed the landscape for people suffering with plaque psoriasis from your perspective?
I really think the number of treatments we have, the advances of treatments has really revolutionized psoriasis, honestly. And that's why I do all the advocacy work I do and continue to do clinical research. I want to give patients hope. I partnered with Alan, Amgen, and Otezla because I really want to empower patients and help them learn about the importance of treating the inflammation from the inside. It may seem obvious that you can easily treat a skin condition that's on the surface with a cream, but not everyone responds in that way. And that's why we're here, to go beyond the surface and look at the importance of treating from within.
Dr. Jennifer, one more question, if I could. We heard Alan's perspective and, you know, what this is like. For you, this is your passion and commitment. I have to ask you, what has hit you deeply in your heart when you work with patients on this, that, you know, the campaign will help us with? And please talk about the new treatment. You know, many of us have seen Otezla on television. We've seen the commercials. But a lot of folks think it's too good to be true. I happen to know it's not. So let's talk about for a minute from your, you know, from a physician's perspective, why Alan's so dang happy.
You know, Alan is a success story, and that's why I do what I do. I want to help people live their life to the fullest, like Alan. And Alan told us about the emotional and mental impact of having this skin condition when it was covering his entire body. And he was able to work with his doctor to find a treatment that worked for him. And look at what an amazing makeup artist he is now. He is hands-on with people. Most people will think, if they're not aware of psoriasis as an infectious or contagious disease, right? Or maybe Alan just never showered. So I think that's why we're here, is to raise awareness and show other patients who are living with psoriasis that you can live your life to the fullest, and there's so many different treatment options. So you wanted to learn more about Otezla, and some other kind of key features about Otezla is that it's an oral medication. So that might be easier for certain patients to take a medication orally, especially when you have multiple plaques all over your body, and it's really hard and messy to put a cream on every day. It's also a medication that doesn't require routine laboratory monitoring. So if you're not a big fan of needles, then this can make it more convenient. But finding the right treatment for you or for a patient, it means working closely with your doctor, whether it's in office or through virtual medicine, is important because every patient responds differently to medication.
All right. Where do we find out more about this? And then I'm going to let everybody know how they can find out more about each of you. But where can people go? What's the website they can find out more? Because clearly, what we're talking about, there are a lot of details for people to know about so people can be informed. See, that's what our network's about. It's all positive talk, and it's all about informed, educated decisions. So without sending people information, you know, we kind of leave them hanging. So I'd like to know from each of you, where do we send people to find out about the treatment? And then people want to know, like, I need to find out about these two. How do we do that?
Well, the website, again, is InsideLookPSO.com, and I think you can probably find out most about my life on my Instagram, which my handle is at AllanFace, which is AllanFace, and you'll get to see my work and even some of the stuff I'm doing with Otezla and Amgen. So that's my thing.
Good. Dr. Jennifer, how about you?
So for me, you can actually find me on my personal website, which is my full name, Jennifer Song, SONGND.com, or checking out my YouTube channel, which has a lot of helpful information, again, empowering patients, and so they can learn more about their skin condition.
Yeah, and that's why I'm asking you this information, because people do want more information. These are really short interviews. Mm-hmm. They want to know, what can I learn about these two? Alan, thank you so much. Alan Avendano, please go look at Alan Avendano. When you go look at the images about this, you're going to see Alan out there. Dr. Jennifer, you're going to be able to find out about her, what her area of expertise is. And, you know, for the wrap-up for me, for both of you, here's what it is. What's your personal message? What do you want to leave us with? And I got to tell you, I love that you are tag-teaming to bring out this message, because there's nothing right now more important for young people, people in general, than self-esteem and self-worth. And this is one of those conditions that can really run riot on that. I think you both will agree. What's each of your personal messages, please?
Mine is to take a deeper look at yourself and love yourself and who you are on the inside, but also take a deeper look at your psoriasis so that you can understand your condition better and so that you can discuss treatment options with your doctor, just so that you can feel as good outside as you do on the inside. Mm.
Dr. Jennifer, how about you?
I would say really find a dermatologist that you truly feel like you can partner with, because psoriasis is a chronic disease and you're going to have ups and downs, and you'll want to work closely with someone to manage that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I got to talk to Alan offline about this. I play a sport called table tennis, and I have a robot that shoots the ball at you at 100 miles an hour. Alan, I got like a giant black eye. I got to talk. We have to talk. Okay.
Oh, my God.
Just say it. You know, whatever the air version I did today, my friends are saying, that doesn't work. Thank you all for tuning in. This is a great segment.
Finally, Dr. Pat, butter color.
Thank you so much. And I want to tell you, we are laughing, but this is serious. For the people that suffer with plaque psoriasis, this is life-changing. And what these two amazing people have just done today is giving you hope. Let's take a short break. Everybody, we'll be right back.
Are you ready to branch out? Take a leap of faith. Tune in to Get Rooted Radio with Erica Gifford Mills on TransformationTalkRadio.com to equip, empower, and enlighten yourself. Erica will energize and excite you to power up your passionate dream that sets your soul on fire. So, get fearlessly ready and get powerfully rooted in your yes. So live it up, love it up, and let it go. Visit GetRootedRadio.com.
Are you trying to lose weight, but feel guilty for eating your favorite foods? Feeling deprived and resentful makes for results that aren't sustainable. Join Adrienne Craig every second and fourth Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com for her show, Master Your Mindset for a Weight Loss Breakthrough. Learn to love the journey and watch yourself succeed. For more information about Adrienne or to work with her personally, visit LifeCanyon.com.
Close your eyes and imagine what it would feel like to live a life driven by purpose and passion. Feels great, doesn't it? Tune in to Awareness to Action every first and third Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific with me, Joan Marlow. I'm here to help you navigate your unique journey toward purpose while embracing your authenticity. Visit my website, peacefullyhealing.com, and don't miss Awareness to Action on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Wow. I love doing these segments, everyone. Now, what if you are born with a common form of dwarfism? But what if your life can change? What if something happens? What if the innovation that you are presented with becomes a change for life? Chandler Cruz is joining me here today, sharing a personal story about what this means, what the opportunities are, and what the future optimism is for people. Chandler, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for bringing your story to the forefront.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
Let's talk about this really, you know, at the point of the beginning point. You know, tell us about your beginnings, what you discovered, and what you're most excited about today.
So I have achondroplasia, which is the most common form of dwarfism. It is caused by a genetic mutation in the FR3 gene. And so a genetic condition that I have for life. And most typically, you know, people with achondroplasia can face many medical complications, such as a narrow foramen magnum, spinal stenosis, ear issues, breathing issues, and most commonly orthopedic issues. And so when I was younger, you know, I was always in visiting with different specialists to prevent or help to treat those complications from occurring. And when I was 16, my legs were very severely bowed, and so I decided to, not only I needed to straighten my legs, but I decided to undergo a series of operations known as limb lengthening.
When you discovered that this was an opportunity for you, what was going on in your mind? What was going on in your heart?
I just knew when I was 16, you know, that's a very, for anyone, but, you know, let's say, you know, for girls, you know, it's just a very kind of hard time in your life,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew, you know, I was only 3'10", and I was done growing, so I was at my full adult height for someone with achondroplasia, and I just kind of knew then that that's not the height I wanted to be for the rest of my life. I felt like there was a lot of just stuff, life kind of things that I was missing out on. But, you know, I just knew that really to, in order to really change my life and to not be 3'10 anymore, the only option for me was going through limb lengthening treatment. And so, you know, I made that decision at 16 to go through that, and, you know, I decided to share my experience in hopes that maybe, you know, if there was anyone else out there like me who kind of wanted, who felt the same way I did, you know, they could sort of refer to, you know, my journey and how I was sharing it, and that really has just snowballed into me becoming an advocate for really any treatment options available or becoming available for those with achondroplasia.
And let's talk about you becoming an advocate, because one of the things that I want people to know is certainly they can find out more about you at the Chandler Project. Is that correct?
Correct. At thechandlerproject.org.
And, you know, I was looking at this, and what I just want to say to people, you know, this is where you can go, you can register, you can find out more, but you can also find out about how hope turns into action. You know, Chandler, for you, well, let's make it clear to people, because I'm not sure I said it, you went through this process, the procedure. Tell people what the end result was.
The end result for me personally was really kind of life that I didn't even realize I was missing out on. You know, the only life I knew was the life I was living. But then after going through the limb lengthening treatment, I realized there was a lot that I didn't realize that I was missing out on. More, you know, personally for me, one that I realized was being able to really have face-to-face communications with people, which it's kind of odd that I didn't realize that at 16, but after going through the limb lengthening treatment, I realized, you know, for me personally, being able to sort of be in that face-to-face range with more of most of my peers was really important to me, and it's kind of been the number one, besides health benefits of the treatment, has been really a rewarding experience going through that.
Mm-hmm. You know, Chandler, not only did you take what people would call a challenging experience, you know, something that you're born with, something that you think there's no option or you think that there's no way to find a possibility, and you've done all of that. You know, I would imagine you've done that with a great team, but now here you are, you know, out in the world and really getting a message out to people to let them know they too can have hope. I want to ask you this. I know we've got a short time left. Please let people know how they find out more. But I'd love to know, as you get ready to have the opening remarks at the upcoming conference, I want to know what's in your heart. What's your personal message? What do you want to say to people here today?
I just want people to know that, you know, you can never have too much information. And at this upcoming conference to really learn about, you know, what new treatments and research are on the horizon for those with achondroplasia, because it's a very exciting time and scary in a way, but, you know, more importantly, it's just a very exciting time with what's happening in terms of treatment options becoming available really for the first time for those with achondroplasia.
Chandler, thank you so much. Please give out the website again. And, you know, thank you for sharing your strength, experience, and hope, and, you know, helping others. What's the best way for us to find out more about this and anything else that you are advocating?
You can find out more by visiting the chandlerproject.org and achondroplasiaresearch.com.
All right, everybody, there you go. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
On this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Wednesday to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your Alternative Talk AM 1150 traffic update for Around the Sound. Well, over on I-5 northbound near the, looks like, on-ramp from South Dearborn Street around Milesville 165, the recent collision partially blocking that ramp. Good thing no medical aid fire systems. It's just blocking that. State Patrol have all arrived on the scene there. Sure, and stay tuned. Coming up next, after the news weather, it's another hour of the Transformation Talk Radio Network. And the psychic and the doc, Mark Anthony and Dr. Pat, they'll be celebrating LGBT Outstanding Professionals with special guest, Kim Powers.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. Bill Cosby is going to walk out of a Pennsylvania state prison a free man, Jennifer Polsoni reports.
The state Supreme Court issuing an opinion to overturn Bill Cosby's sexual assault conviction. His lawyers appealed to the court in December, arguing his trial was biased because it allowed past alleged sex assaults to be presented. The 83-year-old Cosby has served more than 2 years of a 3 to 10 year sentence at a state prison for the 2004 assault of Andrea Constan. He vowed to serve his full 10-year sentence rather than acknowledge any remorse over the 2004 encounter.
Officials confirm four more bodies have been recovered at the site of the South Florida condo collapse. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Caba said that brings the death toll to 16, with 147 people unaccounted for. She said 12 next of kin notifications have been made, but four families are still waiting to hear. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he's spoken to anxious family members and assured them they'll continue to search until everyone is found. President Biden says the threat of wildfires in the western U.S. is as severe as it's ever been.
We know this is becoming a regular cycle, and we know it's getting worse.
Speaking with cabinet officials and governors, he said there must be a whole-of-government response to prepare and make sure no corners are cut when managing wildfires. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is praising former President Trump for his border policy. The pair are taking part in a border security briefing in the Rio Grande Valley. Abbott said the situation at the border has gotten much worse since Trump left office in January. Meanwhile, New York prosecutors are expected to file criminal charges against the Trump Organization tomorrow afternoon. Michael Kastner reports.
Two representatives from the Trump Organization have been told to expect charges to be filed around 2 p.m. Eastern. Earlier this week, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office alluded that any charges will be connected to tax-related conduct. Law enforcement officials are not confirming the timing, and it's not clear if charges will be filed against individuals, namely former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg.
You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
If you're a diabetic, we have great news. You can end the painful finger sticks with a new CGM. Plus, they may be covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance. If you test and inject daily, you may qualify. Call U.S. Med now to learn more.
800-426-0557. 800-426-0557. 800-426-0557. That's 800-426-0557.
And let's go ahead and take a look now at your alternative talk weather outlook for Wednesday. We'll see mostly sunny skies later on today after some of the morning clouds burn off. High temperatures around 81, 82 degrees. Tonight, increasing clouds with low temperatures down to about 64. Thursday, partly cloudy skies to start the day out. High temperatures in the upper 70s, low temperatures at 62. For Friday and running up into the 4th of July weekend, more sunshine expected. High temperatures on the rise in the low 80s to the mid 80s.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat McFilley and Transformation Talk Radio.
There are shows with psychics.
And there are shows with doctors.
But there's no show like the psychic and the doc.
Your practical paranormal power unleashed.
This show synthesizes the talents of world-class medium Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer, psychic explorer,
and street-smart spiritualist, behavioral psychologist, Dr. Pat Facilli. All subjects are on the table, and no topic is taboo. Inspiration, insight,
action, and fun as Mark Anthony connects callers with loved ones in spirit.
In tandem with Dr. Pat's fresh, no-nonsense, street-smart, intuitive insights, and she is hilarious.
Extraordinary problems
require extraordinary solutions, which may come from this side
or the other side. This is The Psychic
and the Doc, and it starts now.
Oh my God, right? Like, OMG.
This is
like,
yes, totally.
I had a flashback already, but I'm going to let you do the introduction. I had a flashback to my younger days, flitting around Asbury Park back in the day, like before, like the salt, like Asbury Park, the center of, am I going to get this right? Before it was LGBTQIA, and it was just Q. I think it was just Q. Asbury Park. Asbury Park. Mark, tell us why we are going to take a trip down memory lane, but then we're going to fast forward.
Well, as everybody knows, June is Pride Month, and we are in for a really special treat today because we have an amazing guest, Tim Powers. And he is a two-time Emmy winner, not one, but two Emmys, and the senior writer for ABC's 2020. Tim is also the author of the recent novel, Rules for Being Dead. And we're going to talk about that because there's a dead character in it that's a narrator, so I find that particularly interesting for me being a medium. But he also wrote Capote in Kansas, and the thriller, Dig Two Graves, which I absolutely loved, and I highly recommend it. There's twists and turns, and you never see what's coming in that. He also wrote the critically acclaimed memoir of his life, The History of Swimming, which is a Barnes & Noble Discover book, and he's a Lambda Literary Award finalist for Best Memoir of the Year. Ken is also a Out 100 by Out Magazine. He's a native Texan, and he received his MFA from Yale School of Drama. He lives in New York City and Asbury Park, New Jersey. And I had the pleasure of meeting Tim when I was on my Never Letting Go book tour in New York City, and I met him in his official capacity at ABC, and we had dinner, and then I went to the book launch for Dig Two Graves, and I just had nothing but total admiration for Tim Powers. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Yeah. Oh, God. Thank you both so much. What a welcome. Can I just like play that every day of my life, you know, when I'm waking up in the morning, having my coffee? Just
yes.
Kind of, oh, yeah, you've done some good things before.
Yes.
Yeah. And
I'm just warming up.
And this last year, as you said, Pat, has brought me to Asbury Park. I've been here during the whole last year of lockdown. And, you know, this stomping ground of Dr. Pat and Bruce Springsteen, I might add, and who I almost ran over, who I almost killed early on when we moved here. I literally saw him crossing the street with his wife, and I was so excited, I barely stopped in time. That would have not only gotten me run out of New Jersey, but maybe the country. But that's another story.
Well, at least you didn't slap the president of France.
I did not slap the president of France. Exactly.
So, I understand. You know, it's funny because in France, I remember when I was at Oxford, one of our professors was talking about the justice system in France. He goes, it's machine gun justice. The guy slapped Macron yesterday. He's already been sentenced today to 4 months in prison. So bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah.
But Jim, I have to ask, we talk a lot about the afterlife on this show, and I love working with Dr. Pat because, you know, people call in and I'll do a mini reading, and then she gives her street smart spiritualist insights, which is extremely healing to people. But in your new book, Rules for Being Dead, there is a dead character who's the narrator. Come on, you got to tell us about that. How did you get the idea to have a narrator that's dead?
Right now, it seems like, to me, looking back, it seems like the most obvious idea in the world. But I have to tell you, I was so many drafts through that book before I even came up with that idea. And it's a story, it's a work of fiction, but it's a very autobiographical work about my childhood and me dealing with the mystery of my mother's death, who died when I was 9 years old.
That's
and
right.
People were very kind of quiet about it, not really saying anything about it. You know, my imagination ran wild with what might have happened to her. But I'd written a sort of basic book, you know, all these events. And a friend of mine said, you know, it's all about your mother, but she's not really a character in it. She only has other people talk about it. He goes, I want to hear what she has to say for herself. And I thought, well, she's dead. She really can't talk for herself. And I thought, actually, she can. You know, there are other books. I'm, not by far the first to have written like this. The Lovely Bones, for example, is narrated by a dead teenage girl. And I thought, I really do want, even though it is so close to home, I wanted to give this character of the mother, who's a wife and a mother of two little boys. She's a grade school teacher during the 60s, growing up in small town Texas. I wanted to give her freedom to say whatever she wanted to. And I almost wanted to let my mind go wild so I could, almost in an unconscious way, I think the way Mark, you have, you know, visitations almost. I wanted to see what she would come alive and tell me. And it was both the easiest character I've ever written, and there's some, you know, some specific things about my mother in it, but also a fictional take on her, and my favorite character I've ever written.
Yeah.
And there she is. She's sort of floating in limbo, not able to escape or be taken to heaven or hell or whatever the other world is, while she's fiercely guarding these two little boys. And she essentially sort of fly in this invisible character flying around in this small town in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Kim, I have a question, and then Dr. Pat, I'm going to want your input because
sure.
This is going to involve both of you. Both of you lost your mothers at a very young age.
Yep.
But Kim, my understanding is you had an identical twin brother who died at a very young age.
A twin brother, not identical, but a twin brother.
But twin, oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. So,
fraternal twin.
Okay. So you write a lot of books that involve death, and now you've written a book that involves a spirit. And by the way, I have to say, when I was reading about the character's name is Creola Perkins, which I
yes,
love the
really.
Name. And,
which is my mother's real name.
Oh, okay, great. Even better.
Yeah.
Your insights on the spirit and the way spirits can see past, present, and future, you were very, very, very accurate. So kudos.
Did
a great job.
I didn't do, and this is not sucking up to you, but I remember reading Never Letting Go right after we met the first time, and you were kind enough to give me a copy of it. And, you know, as always, since I was a kid and had so much loss in my life early on, and then my two brothers had also died at, in the early 90s, it's always been a great fascination to me, of course.
Sure.
And I remember reading that in there about spirits sort of being able to not tell the future, but in a, again, another unconscious way, I came up with this funny thing for the mother to do where she could sort of see what her this main child, Clark, how he's growing up and what he's like in high school or college. And, you know, she almost like predicts this thing called Facebook and emojis.
Yeah,
you know, writing in the middle of the 60s. And I wanted to give her this great sense of humor, but I think subconsciously I've been thought, well, I do think that is what spirit has, an ability to see past, present, and future. Yeah.
Awesome. So Dr. Pat, I wanted to ask that, okay, from a psychologist standpoint, Tim writes a book where essentially his mother is and is not the narrator. Do you think that this is a really powerful form of therapy to deal with grief? What's your take on how this has come together?
Okay, I'll give you my take on it. First of all, when I read your book, I wondered about what you just shared. And the reason I wondered about it is because you and I could have been two peas in a pod parallel. My mom died when I was six, and I was in Catholic boarding school. And I've shared this story. And this is not the psychology of this, but what this lends itself to, Mark, is how do we get shaped to become the people we are today? How do these events of our lives shape us? Now, here's what I'm going to say. You know, I got kicked out of Catholic boarding school at age six because I told Sister Michael Anthony at the ninth station of the cross that Jesus just told me my mom was with him. And they know how to grab you, like, by the ear and stuff?
Yeah, I went to Catholic.
Grab you to the Mother Superior. And I've shared that story before. And I walk into Mother Superior, and Sister Michael Anthony is yelling and screaming. She did it again. She's talking to Jesus. Whatever they say, sacrilege. Pulls up her head and she's crying. She's got a note from my dad. My mom just died.
Oh.
Now, when I think about this and I think about your book and I've read your book, and there are points in this book where I just bawled.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how did I get to know about my mother's passing? I never knew. It was a dark secret, Kim. It was dark. And I spent a lot of my years drinking about it down at Asbury Park. And I also lost the two key people in my life, my birth sister and my stepmother, in 91 and 2. And so when I start to listen to this, here's what I come to answer your question. See, I think spirit, God, universe, whatever you believe in, is so smart that what happens is it shapes us to create a narrative about our lives that will help other people. And so two things come to mind to answer the question. There's something freeing in knowledge and writing about this, something freeing. When my stepmom violated my dad's words and kept my birth mom's letters from the mental ward of Bellevue Hospital, talking about her first suicide attempt because she was in Bellevue, talking about the situation behind it, and then finally her second attempt shortly thereafter where she burned the whole house down. But had those letters not been kept, and had my stepmom not kept them, I would have had a cockamamie story that would have never made sense to my life. So yes, the answer to the question is when we write things down and we put them in narrative and we are sharing something from the heart, like my stepmom waited for my dad to die. We're burying my dad. We're burying my dad. And we finish the burying and we go back to the house. And of course, my sisters have got to drink themselves to death, which is good. because they shared a lot of information about stuff that I didn't do as a child that I really got blamed for. And my mother goes and gets these letters. She goes and gets the letters. In the revelation of those letters, and you read them, there's a level of freeing. And I think, Kim, that's what this is about. There's a level of freedom that's very hard to explain when you put this down. But also, there's an honoring. And when we can honor those people that were so instrumental to us that have taken our life away, my mom owned an old school candy store and jukebox. And you talk about Elvis Presley. So the psychology of this is that what happens with some of this when we write our stuff down is we are releasing so that we can love. Releasing so we can love, right? So you release something so you could love. But I will tell you, right after that thing, I went on a tirade. I got a hold of my uncle. I got a hold of all my relatives. And I said, what's wrong with you people? Why were you keeping this a secret? Mom wasn't sick. She was an addict and alcoholic, and my dad was cheating on her, and it's all in the letters here. Look at the letters. By the way, on my mom's side of the family, I got completely cut off. But if we can't share our stories, what are we? I mean, this goes back from when man could walk and then flap at the mouth, and woman. And it began storytelling. So it is not only transformative, Mark, but what this does, and Kim, this allows other people to face themselves and face their stories. Long answer to a question.
Yeah, and Kim, I think it kind of goes without saying that a lot of creativity stems from pain. You look at, I found in my work as a medium and a grief, for lack of a better term, grief counselor, that some of the greatest works of art literature, all right, we have somebody who's created great works of literature, meaning you, music, have come from grief. And what's fascinating about you is certainly the deaths of your brothers and your mom were very impactful. But you also had to confront and cope with growing up as a gay child in what I presume to be an extremely conservative environment. Okay. How did that impact you first as a person and then secondly as a writer?
Well, you're certainly right. It could not have been more deep fried where I came from, you know. Southern Baptist, Bible Belt, all the way in small town Texas. And it was a profound thing, you know, just imagine a kid just dealing with all this stuff, you know, the death of my mother, Dr. Pat, our families could have been the same. I mean, I went through all of those things. I found my mother trying to kill herself. I rescued her from a suicide attempt. I had a bunch of letters of hers that really told me her truth. So there's so many parents. I had two brothers who died in 91, 92, just like you. And so I'm dealing with the shame, and it was shameful and embarrassing to me that my mother had died, and no other parents of my other friends had. So that was almost a bigger feeling than the grief.
Yeah.
And just because there was so much mystery about how she died, what killed her, I moved into that embarrassment. But just imagine that at the same time, I was a very sensitive child. I was what, you know, people would think of as stereotypically feminine. You know, I was very slight. And with this twin brother, we were fraternal, but he was always a little bit bigger than I was. He was always a little bit more masculine acting. You know, my voice probably sounded very gay. You know, I wanted to be an actor from the time I was a kid. I write about that certainly in the book, and you know, to see all these old movies that other kids in McKinney, Texas, population 18,000, were not going to see. So it was just like another part of like dealing and surviving. You know, and you just sort of make your peace with it. You know, this phrase, that had sort of a trendy moment, you know, a few years ago, it gets better. you know, that whole it gets better movement.
Yeah.
I did not have it gets better. There were no people who had already lived past what I had gone through and gone forward and now successful, happy, productive, saying it gets better to me. You know, I was kind of figuring it out for myself. And I will add, and this is in my first book, The History of Swimming, not only was I gay, but my two brothers were gay as well. Now, that was not something we dealt with as children, but both my twin brother and an older brother who was 12 years older were all gay. So it was even weirder, you know, this family of gay kids. You know, what was in the water then, you know, that we were drinking or something? I mean, thankfully, you know, and again, small-minded Texas. I mean, there's small minds everywhere. I don't mean to pick on Texas, but, you know, it had a lot of small minds there, and it really was only when I escaped, and I use that term kind of literally, to New York after college, that I really felt like I came into my own, I could be myself, you know, certainly, and this was in the late 70s, early 80s, there's no need to hide who you were. I luckily can say, especially because I was in the arts, I was in theater and movie and TV development, I've never had to hide my identity on a professional basis. That never kept me from getting a job or whatever. In fact, it probably helped me along the way.
I have a question, if I may. I've heard some people say, I'm successful in spite of being gay, not because of it. Would you say that applies to you, or do you feel that you're successful because you're gay, or do you feel that that's just part of who you are and not your driving force?
It's part of who I am. But at the same time, I don't want to deny it. It has made me a very specific kind of person. I remember once I was working at PBS, and we had to do, you know, these kind of touchy-feeling, employee exercises, you know, sensitivity trainings and stuff. And we had to come up with, I think it was four phrases to define ourselves.
Yep.
And two of them I vividly remember, and they just came to me like that. And one was gay, and one was a fallen Texan. Not a Texan, but a fallen Texan, which sort of describes my relationship to Texas. You know, it's like you can take the boy out of Texas, but to this day, you can't take Texas out of the boy. And I feel like they very much have shaped, being gay has shaped my personality and my sense of humor. But it's not, you know, sometimes celebrities will come out, you know, they'll be outed or they'll come out and they'll say, oh, I hope to prove to you that being gay is the least important part of my life, say that. I would say it's a major part of my life, but it is not, it's just kind of one of the tributaries, like feeding into the big lake, big swampy lake of who I am, you know.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating the way you described it. I'm sorry, Dr. Pat, go ahead.
Well, I think you talked about three things. One, I used to be those people that ran those trainings, and then two, I had to do it myself. And, you know, what's fascinating about going through those trainings, you're the only person in the room that doesn't think you're gay or won't admit you're gay. And I love that because when you have to identify everybody before you establish the ground rules, right?
Yeah.
You're in the room and everybody has to go in a corner or define themselves as an animal. And somebody turns to you and says, seriously, you're in that corner?
Yeah.
And then to me, what are you doing in the straight corner? I mean, it wasn't called that, but
right.
Yeah, and so there are these defining moments. I'd love to ask you this question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you think of a defining moment for yourself?
Do you know what? In a way, we've already talked about it. The death of my mother was the defining event of my life until my early 30s. And then the defining moments became the death of my twin brother. But I will say, even in college, at both college and grad school, I was constantly writing pieces about the death of my mother. I was still trying to process that when I was in my 20s, you know, whether it was writing a little autobiographical thing or whatever it might have been. And maybe it's different when the parent dies and the kid is much older. I don't know. For me, it was that. And then it's really sort of BC and AD. And, you know, for my twin brother as well. And I think just the proximity of both brothers dying of AIDS within the same year.
Yeah.
Was such a knockout year.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was before and after. Yeah. And, I don't know if that's too morbid because there are other great celebrations I've had in my life, you know, where accomplishments of mine have been rewarded, you know, at a book party like the one Mark and Rocky came to, or, you know, a movie I made got premiered or whatever. Those pump me up. Those are great. But in terms of like shaping my core personality, almost to the point of changing my DNA, I would say, those are the two most profound ones.
I saw it was, first of all, thank you for posting on Facebook that you're going to be on the show tonight. And then you said, we're going to talk about all sorts of things like Judy Garland's birthday. Okay.
Which is
it's funny because from what I see, like, I think gay men from 40 on up all venerate Judy Garland. 40 on down is apparently, it used to be Madonna, now it's Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is it about Judy Garland?
Do you know what? It's so funny because I am sort of the post-Judy, you know, I think my adoration of Judy, as we call her, Queen Judy, sort of became almost started as like mimicry or a joke of, you know, the generation one above me who really were there at Stonewall in the 70s and her death and everything. But I do know that... something about The Wizard of Oz. It really is. It's about the fantasy and the heartbreak and the finding home. It's really about her finding her own family and choosing it. That is what that journey in Oz does. She's with the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion. And that is her own chosen family in the way so many gay people and, you know, LGBTQ people have to find their own families. And I'm lucky in that my family, you know, didn't have any real issues with me being gay or anything. But so many others are not like that. They do have to deal with being kicked out or not loved. And I think, well, you know, you don't know that when you're watching Mrs. Maz. You're just thinking, oh, my God, will she, you know, kill the witch in time? But I think at the core, that's what it's about. And I think that's why we all have this kind of special place for her. And Over the Rainbow is such a fantasy and so fantastic, and it's what not just gay people, but I think everybody wants to find their own version of Over the Rainbow. What is the most ideal place you can be or imagine being where everything's perfect? I really do think it's those two things in Wizard of Oz.
You know, it's really fascinating when you said about Over the Rainbow. I remember when I was putting together the PowerPoint, the slideshow for my own mother's passing, and she always admired Judy Garland, big band and all that. And so I put in the soundtrack, Over the Rainbow. Remember, my dad and I were sitting there listening to it, and he said, that's heaven.
It is heaven.
And all of a sudden I thought, oh, my God, you know, that song has so many different interpretations to it. And I think that when you're talking about The Wizard of Oz, and Dr. Pat, definitely chime in on this one. Think about each of the characters. Judy Dorothy is everyman, okay? The Tin Woodsman, he's our blue-collar worker. Scarecrow is the intellectual. Cowardly Lion, the LGBT community, okay? But I saw this one comedian one time, and he was talking about that movie, and he said it taught us all very important lessons, that beautiful people are always good and kind and trustworthy, and that ugly people are always evil and mean, and it's okay to kill them. And I'm kidding. For all our listeners, I'm kidding.
I'm not even going to touch that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I am the generation before you. I am, and we talked about this, I'm not going to go into it ad nausea again, but I know what it's like to have been there at Stonewall. I know the truth about it, vaguely talks about it, and thank you for the lesbian that refused to go in that paddy wagon, girlfriend, right? But it was a different time.
And I want to ask you about this. And what I mean by a different time, it's so great to be looking out and watching Westworld. Okay, this is my version of a great time. Watching Westworld and looking at Evan Rachel Wood and saying, she came out.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry if I'm outing you, but I think you did come out. Well, even if you didn't, there it is. Everybody's talking about you, Evan. But everybody's talking about you being out. But the reason I bring it up is it seems like things have changed. And I want to ask you this question. We'll come back from break. How have things have changed? What have you seen? What are you seeing today? And, you know, can we think about some of our pop culture people? You know, can we take a look at maybe Billie Eilish? I don't know. Can we look at Asia Kate Dillon? You know, can we look at some of these folks and yet still look back at the pioneers? You know, we beat the doors down to just, I won't say it, just Ed Koch, please grow a pair. I mean, these are the things, but I want to ask you when we come back, when you look at the landscape, where are we today and what are you most excited about for the future? I'd love to talk with you about
that. Yeah, absolutely.
Mark, how about a break?
Sounds good to me.
All right, Jessica, it's all you. We'll be right back. We're back in that jazz music, aren't we? I don't know. What happened to the rap music, Benny?
Oh, my God.
There you go.
Thank you, God. I like it.
You're welcome.
I'm going to save that in my car. Boy, I got to have me some fake something now. I'm telling you.
Get in the groove with Dr. Pat and her guests on Transformation Talk Radio. It's always something new around here. Visit thedrpatshow.com.
Good music.
Yeah, everybody. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Psychic and the Doc. We have a very special guest today. Look, before we jump ahead, Jim, what is the best way for people to find out about you, get copies of your books, all of the above? Kind of follow you?
Yeah, I'm very active on social media with a lot of kind of crazy alter egos there. But so you can go to my website, which is KimPowersBooks.com, and the information. I've got four books, a play I've written, various other things, and, you know, every bookstore, love to shop indies, love to shop local, has copies of the books. The early ones you might have to order because they're not currently in stock, but and just look me up on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. I'm on all of them. Yeah.
And, you know, Kim, I'd like to add to something you just said. I get so many people that say, I went to Barnes & Noble and they didn't have your book. Well, there's this thing called the customer service desk. And you go there and you say, I want this book, and they'll order it for you. So if you want to read Kim's books, and let me tell you, I've read a number of your books. They're awesome. Dig Two Graves, that one just kept me up at night. And then The Rules for Being Dead is just outstanding. And Dr. Pat, I know you want to get to the changes, but Capote in Kansas, I have to ask, what was your motivation for writing this book?
Do you know what? And this you know, it pops up a little bit in Rules for Being Dead. There's a little 9-year-old boy who is obsessed with Truman Capote, and more so the clutter killings in Kansas.
Yeah.
I found my way into Truman Capote through In Cold Blood. And that's, you know, like a creepy thing a 9-year-old kid should not be thinking about or dealing with. And I was sort of obsessed in a bad way with serial killers. So I started just, you know, reading everything I could about Truman Capote, and I discovered that he and Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, were next-door neighbors when they were kids. And I thought I was the only one who knew that. I mean, it was hardly a secret. But I had this lifelong obsession with them. And I will add that is the first, it's Capote in Kansas: A Ghost Story. because that is actually the first place I've written about ghosts. And it's the dead Clutter family coming back to haunt Truman Capote and haunt Lee. And the way they're written, you don't know if they're dreams that they're having or they're real ghosts. And I'm not sure I know the difference, which is an interesting thing. You know, I think we get visitations from spirits through dreams myself.
Yes.
But I first began sort of exploring that world of these characters who were visiting from another place, let me say that, in Capote in Kansas. Yeah.
Wow, well, thank you. Yeah, I love the way, I mean, I guess your books speak to me because they have spirits as characters in them. And I'm a writer, Dr. Pat's a writer, you know, and we all have our process. And it's funny when you said, I'm not even sure I know, because sometimes the message just comes out, and then I'm looking at it going, where did that come from?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And it's usually really good when that happens.
It's usually the best. When you don't know where it came from, is the best writing you can do. Yeah.
Yes. Dr. Pat, you were going to talk about, like, where we are now and where we're going and as far as, like, treatment of LGBT. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, the reason I want to talk about it is, and I just got a text message. Not Billy Idol, but we could do a show on Billy Idol. We could do that for sure. There's no question. Billy Eilish and some people. So Billy writes a song. I want to talk about two things. Billy writes a song, Wish You Were Gay. I have never seen, I have to think of another, yes, one other song I could think of in modern, contemporary, if we can consider Katy Perry still contemporary. What was the other song that caused as much backlash as this?
Oh, I Kissed a Girl. I Kissed a Girl.
Oh, yeah. And I liked it.
Here's what I love about this, and this is why my question to you. Back in the day, if somebody would have done this, if the movie Carol would have been revealed by the original author, what a movie.
Yeah.
Please. Somebody, please reach out to those two and have them do part two. Please. You've got to get them back together. But if we go back in time, and we know there were artists, we know there were people in the industry that talked about things, that came out about things, and then there were some that were hidden. But here's my question to you. My sense is we've moved to a new level. Why do I say that? I Kissed a Girl, Wish You Were Gay, two songs written by people not gay at the moment, not gay, I don't know. I Kissed a Girl, incredible success, right, except in a lot of other communities. And I love Billie Eilish. I love the response. I have never seen a single song be released with so much dialogue that has completely elevated the LGBTQIA community to talk about being out or not being out until, you know, Billy says, you know, it's not about the F and this. So my question to you is, we are in a new era. Are we excited about it?
I think we're very excited about it. I mean, it's, you know, I feel like this old fart at my office, for example. You know, because there are all these kids, you know, who come in as interns or, you know, our staff. You know, I'll go out in the hallway and, you know, I need a millennial to help me do something on the computer. But there's just no question about it. There's no doubt. There's no uncertainty. And I see it in so much, you know, and I think it's because the modeling we get in songs like those you just mentioned, in characters we get, you know, high school dramas on TV, you know, they're gay, bi, trans, whatever characters, and it's just sort of taken for granted now. I don't think it's kind of cool, you know, to be gay. I even sound like a, you know, old fogey sounding saying that, but I always thought, it's interesting, even my own work, evolution, because I spent so many years and so much energy in the AIDS activism world while my two brothers were ill and then after they died. And I, I couldn't have given any more. I thought the fight was over for me. That was my own personal Waterloo. I didn't have any more else to give. And I had younger friends, like a generation younger than me, who were already moving. I mean, and this is like, you know, in the 90s, onto the, marriage equality bandwagon.
Right.
And I said, no, it's not my battle. You know, it won't ever happen in my lifetime. You go on and do the good fight. I just, you know, I'm closed for business. But then when we got it, when we started getting it bit by bit, and I was able to marry my own partner, I thought, you know, it is a new world. You know, I can remember our tax guy. We would go to our tax guy, and he'd say, oh, but you're never going to see marriage equality. You'll never be able to file as a couple, blah, blah, blah. And I was terrified of that. And being an older person, you know, having to pay an inheritance tax, say, on our house or something like that. So I just see these changes, and I hate to see the backwards changes that some, you know, in Florida, a bill against trans athletes or something.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I just remember so well, this is, at this point, 4 or 5 years ago, Diane Sawyer did, you know, this epic interview with Caitlyn Jenner, and in which Bruce Jenner came out as Caitlyn Jenner. And I remember so often Diane saying, trans rights are the new civil rights. And I thought that was so prophetic and prescient. And it really is the truth. You know, I don't necessarily like what Caitlyn Jenner has become in the path she's gone in, but it is the new civil rights, you know? And I hate, you know, fearing that some LGBTQ rights will be taken away, you know? Who knows what's going to happen in the courts in the next year or so.
Yes,
but
exactly.
I find, you know, I'm like, you know, for my younger gay friends who don't know Judy and don't know those classic old movies, you know, I give them like a little starter kit, like Gay 101. Okay, you've got to watch The Women. You've got to watch Stage Door. You've got to watch All About Eve. And I'll like give them the little stepping stones to be, you know, an elder gay like I am, so that they'll know the references. Okay, this is what Jungle Red means, you know, all that stuff. So,
you know, I want to point this out. Well, the reason I think we do this show, and I said to Mark, look, on my show, I have had to speak out this month. I mean, every year we do something, but there's something even more important about it. You know, what's happening in the joy of the conversations about some of the folks we've talked about and some of the things that have been done, in the spirit of that, please, please look and make sure you check this. Voting rights are not being changed just for people of color. I just want, you know, please look at this. And today, I had to make an announcement on my earlier show, and I posted, and I said, do you ladies out there know that a bill to give you equal wages was just shot down today, a filibuster? Do we know that? Equal wages for women? And so I'm at this place where I'm really, you know, here I sit with the network. We're going to grow and expand in 18 months to 10 channels. And when I went back to my team and I said, I got to have a political channel. I got to have a different political channel. I got to have a channel that is going to provide information. Provides us with asking ourselves, I think, where we've been. And that was my question to you. It's, let's take a shot at looking ahead and the possibilities of what we can achieve. We've achieved a lot.
Yeah.
People say, you haven't done anything yet. Yeah, okay, come on. Like marriage? Seriously?
He's Buttigieg.
Exactly.
A credible candidate. You know, I mean, it's like I saw him being interviewed, I think, yesterday, with the infrastructure bill and all this, and it's like, it's just amazing to see how far that we've come. And, you know, Dr. Pat, we're talking about women having equal wages. You know, I grew up in an era where I had women professors. I worked in law firms side by side with women. I've had women bosses. And for me, I have never had a problem. I mean, first off, I wouldn't have a problem with that, but I don't understand the ridiculousness of a woman not getting paid the same thing as a man. I've never seen that. And just think, women are still struggling, and Kim, gays are still struggling. Yes, there's been leaps forward, but there are forces at work to try to turn back time, if you will.
Yeah.
And what the people who want to turn things back fail to understand is that there is no going back. We were talking about this recently, Dr. Pat, about COVID. You know, people say, well, we want to get back to where we were. Well, the post-pandemic world isn't going to just be 2019 again. It's going to be a new normal. And so I think it's fascinating, the changes in our society, because there are countries in the world, and Kim, you're with ABC News, so you understand. I mean, there's countries where gays are openly persecuted. Kim, you're a role model. What do you have to say to that scared lesbian teenager, that scared boy who's getting picked on, to that transgendered teen that doesn't know who to turn to? What are your words? What's your advice? What's your message?
Say, don't kill yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's easier said than done, because we've all been there, I know. But it is a harder not to kill yourself than to kill yourself. And if you can just hang on, you know, and for a lot of people, it's just hang on until you get out of high school. Then you can start finding your own tribe, your own people, and glory in them. You know, create your own family if you need to at that point. But just try to hang on to find your own tribe. I know these things sound trite. I guess I think that's back to what I did. There were enough, you know, other freaks that I could hang out with in high school that I felt not quite so alone, and, you know, gave me a little bit of a sense of stability and protection even. So just, if you can just find one other person to talk to that you feel safe to, do that. Don't ever bottle it up. You know, let it out in a safe space.
Yeah. Let me take you back on that for a minute, because I want to talk about the silent death and the slower death. And the silent and slower death is the level of alcohol consumption. I work with the LGBTQ community and women in general in recovery, and I've never seen such challenges. So there is the point that you get to, and I think when you talk to many of us, when you talk to what the journey was like, you've had those moments of it. But there's a slower death, and it is at epidemic levels. And, you know, if we don't start to acknowledge it and show up for it, you know, this is the point by which, you know, the self-annihilation and letting that level of fear completely consume us is a slower death that ultimately leads to the death. And, you know, we're not talking about that so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was practicing law, in Florida, I remember I had this juvenile client. He must have been, I think, 16 or 17. And he would always come to talk to my secretary. And she said, Mark, we got a situation here. And I said, what? She said, he just admitted to me that he was gay. And I, you know, we could kind of tell, you know. And she said, but he wants us to set up a meeting with his parents to come out. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. So we did, you know, and these people were real country. And look, like you said, Kim, I don't want to, you know, trash on Florida country people, but they came in, like, his mom's missing half her teeth and dad's like, oh, they're sitting down. And I said, now, you know, we're going to have a discussion here. And I, you know, and I'll just say, you know, his name was Jim, you know, I'm just making a Jim is gay. And his mother goes, well, hell, we knew that. His father goes, yeah, I kind of figured, but we love you anyway. And this kid, I just saw, like, the sweat pouring off of him. He was so relieved. But the family was very thankful that we set up this environment, because he was scared to death to talk to them, and they didn't know how to bring it up.
It's so fantastic. I never would have taught something like that. And they don't teach you that in law school, I'm sure.
No.
But what a great thing for this kid to have you as – can just soak up his psychic energy, you know, take some of the fear off him and put it on yourself.
because you're a grown up and you can handle it. But how fantastic is that, you know?
Yeah, you know, because I've seen, we certainly have seen in the news how so many people of African American, people of color are not being treated properly by law enforcement. The LGBT community, Dr. Pat, you have firsthand experience being at Stonewall, I called in another interview we did the Gay Fourth of July. Okay. But I saw in my work both as a prosecutor and a criminal offense attorney how gays have been brutalized by law enforcement. But I'm also encouraged seeing that changing as well, that people are being treated with more respect. And, you know, you got to hand it to you, Dr. Pat, your generation, and Kim. Your generations were the trailblazers that stood up and said, we're not taking this anymore. And I think for all of our listeners that have gay members in the family or gay children or our listeners who are gay or gay or LGBT, I really want to thank you for tuning into the Psychic and the Doc, because – as we said, no topic is off the table. No subject is taboo here. And this is a very important discussion. You know, people think, all right, there's gay marriage, it's all over. It's like, no, it isn't. And Kim, you work, you know, you're tremendous success, and you're at ABC. How do you balance your career as a writer and with your work at ABC?
You know what, I've always been very driven, and, you know, it's not, and my parents were sort of basic hard workers, but they were not slavish about it or anything, and maybe in high school, I always knew that was the road to college, you know, and I was innately smart, but I also knew that working hard, you know, would get me the good grades to get scholarships or whatever. And I grew up in a poor family that my family didn't have money for that. But I always need projects to be doing. And, you know, I learned with my first book that you just, you know, a mentor of mine once said, you know, if you want to be a writer, just write. You can't keep talking about writing. You just have to. And there's usually like one time when you make that, the first time when you make that commitment to just write. And I feel like I've had that a few times in my life. But I've always sort of been able to juggle these projects, get the stuff at work done. And usually by then I'm too tired to work at night. But really get up in the morning and now really work on the weekends, work hard. And it sort of moved into stuff I enjoy rather than something I feel I have to do for my ego. You know, I've checked off enough boxes for my ego. I'm fine with that. Now it's just for me and my sense of putting work out there and what I want to say. You know, having a platform, I guess, is why I do it. But I will say, though, the back half of that question is the discipline I got at ABC. And I started as a writer from Good Morning America, long days, and we had to pump out what was called like a briefing paper for the anchors on some subject every day. So I was writing 6-7 pages a day. That discipline, just like going to the gym and developing that writing muscle of getting a draft down, or we said the words, you know, bad words are better than no words. So get some words down on the page. Then you can fix them later. That gave me the discipline and sort of the muscle memory, literally, to do the physical act of writing. That's what it is, doing it every day,
yeah.
Whether inspiration struck or not. Yeah, but that's how I do it, one day at a time.
Yeah. And I think if we had more time, we could really take a deeper dive into what we're not talking about on the greatest challenges in the LGBTQIA community. And those are the things we don't talk about. Now, clearly, if anybody watches Law & Order SVU, thank you, Mariska Hargitay. I want to thank you for you standing up and producing those shows that nobody really wanted you to produce, those shows that show abuse, sexual abuse and otherwise, of people in our community that never make it past the side of the street. And I do really want to take my hat off to her and the producers of that show, because you learn more about what's going on from that show and the community than most, but also from you, Kim, and doing shows like this for us. You become a champion of what's to come.
My complete honor. You're so kind to invite me. I in no way see myself as a role model. You're very kind to say that. I'm just older than everybody. That's what I'm going down to. If you make it to a certain age and you haven't completely screwed up, you can be a role model. And that's all I'll take from that. So thank you both so much.
You know, Kim, you have to come back, because I didn't even get to my questions about your play. So yeah, and I'm sure that is there another? I know that you're promoting Rules for Being Dead. Is there another book in the works?
There is another book in the works, and I'll just tell you the title, and that's all I'll tell you. Hot Mike, which is a mic that's still live, but there is both a live mic and a character named Hot Mike in it. So it might take place in the newsroom, maybe.
Kim, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Are you going to get Shannon painting for that, Rose?
I would love to.
Thank you so much. What a great conversation. Mark, take us away.
I'm Mark Anthony, and I'm with my amazing co-host, Dr. Pat DeFilly. You're listening to The Psychic and the Doc. We've had author and ABC writer Kim Powers as our guest, and we will see you next week as we continue celebrating superstars in the LGBT community for Pride Month. For everyone, please tune in, and we will be doing call-in shows this month. Many blessings, and namaste, everyone. Have a great day.
Evan Rachel Wood, please. Thank you all for tuning us in, turning us on. Kim, you rock. We'll see you next time. Dr. Pat Basile, right.